The thing about the capitalist system is its alienation. It's totally built in. When money, profit becomes the most important driving force in a society, the real issues of life, meaning, spiritual issues, issues of your own purpose in life, all those things become secondary. The capitalist system completely undermines any sense that we have a big purpose here, that every human being is valuable, that every human being can contribute.
It's getting kind of dangerous to be into this consciousness. They label you a terrorist. So some are choosing ignorance, claiming that it's bliss. But that's not for this evolutionist. I choose to remain a revolutionist like Jesus Christ is to the Roman Empire. I'm one with the fire, rise with the smoke, touch the mountain peaks where Creator spoke, inspiring hope. So now I'm dreaming revolution.
Special presentation of People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton, led in large part by poet, writer, activist, and revolutionary Luis Rodriguez. A group of people, primarily young people in Los Angeles, California, created Dreaming Revolution. Dreaming Revolution was created to bring together the energy and forces of the hip-hop culture and revolutionary politics, along with a solid grounding in indigenous spirituality, perennial values, wisdom, science, and philosophy, taking the best of what the elders had to offer and melding it with the energy and new ideas of the young. Today, we'll bring you a report on Dreaming Revolution 4, which was held in Los Angeles in January of this year. This is also one in a series of six radio programs entitled Dreaming Revolution, produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League of Revolutionaries for a New America also publishes the paper The People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. In this edition of Dreaming Revolution, we'll also bring you a report on the San Francisco Peace March and Rally, which took place on January 18th. These two movements, Dreaming Revolution, made up primarily of young people of color, and the anti-war movement, led by primarily older white political activists, are on a convergence course along with anarchists, anti-globalists, and anti-capitalists. If and when these groups unite along a common line of march, they'll form a force with enough power to bring about a global revolution. It's in this spirit that we present this edition of Dreaming Revolution. Dreaming Revolution has as its roots the Zapatista Revolution, which took place in Mexico during the mid-1990s. One of the leaders of that revolution, Subcomandante Marcos, proved to be a thoughtful and articulate speaker on behalf of the poor and indigenous people of that area. In part, taking inspiration from the words of Marcos, award-winning writer and poet Luis Rodriguez helped to create the event that became known as Dreaming Revolution. The author of Mi Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., gave the keynote address at Dreaming Revolution 4.
There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. The tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding, but you don't never let go of that thread. That's by a poet, William Stafford. The poem is called The Way It Is. This past Wednesday, the White House postponed a poetry symposium hosted by First Lady Laura Bush. There were concerns, according to reports, that the event would be, quote, politicized. The symposium was set for February 12th. It was on the poetry of Emmeline Dickinson, Langston Hughes, and Walt Whitman. According to Mrs. Bush's spokesperson, while Mrs. Bush respects the right of Americans to express their opinions, she too has opinions and believes it would be inappropriate to turn a literary event into a political forum. Can you imagine postponing a discussion on poets like Hughes and Whitman who were political, feisty, and even outrageous because you don't want it to become political? It was Langston Hughes who wrote, "Oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." And even though war is political, nobody who can is postponing that. Despite the millions in the United States and around the world who have actively protested this pending war, the Bush administration is unilaterally going to war anyway. It is a war against a country that has never committed an act of aggression against the United States. Iraq has never been linked to 9/11. Iraq was not behind the anthrax attacks. In fact, for all the weapons of mass destruction that Iraq is supposed to be hiding, it is considered a minor military power, the 12th largest in the world. The U.S. is the first. In fact, Time magazine recently ran an online poll on who was the biggest threat to peace in the world today. For some reason, they included the United States in that list of dangerous countries. By mid-January, the poll had the U.S. leading at 73.2%, with Iraq at 16.5%. Yet the world's most powerful military machine in history, at a cost of over $200 billion, is being activated against Iraq's possible future aggression for a future non-act. This is the same kind of logic that also elected a president by a decree of 9 Supreme Court justices in the shenanigans of a state governed by that president's brother while losing mightily in the popular election. Apparently, logic doesn't have any bearing on this presidency. What happened to Osama bin Laden? What happened to the terrorists without a country? What happened to common sense? While this government prepares for war, it tries to turn our heads away from some of the more pressing issues that won't go away just because we won't look at them. Last year, there were 33 million U.S. households with no adequate food supply. 13 million children resided in those households. Today, one in every 8 Americans is poor, and this number is increasing every year. Federal, state, and county governments are slashing housing programs, school programs, health care. Jobs are being cut in the service industry, manufacturing, warehousing, and technology. And our long and hard fought for environmental protections are being compromised or removed on a daily basis. As Charles Dickens once said more than 100 years ago, these are the worst of times. Yet for many corporations, these are in fact the best of times. In the same period, Boeing, one of the country's largest defense companies, recently doubled its production of kits that make dumb bombs smart at $25,000 a pop. Raytheon added a shift to produce its Paveway laser-guided bombs at $55,600 a piece. Alien Tech Systems is churning out 265 million rounds of small arms ammunition at a cost of $92 million tax dollars. The Predator unmanned surveillance and attack craft is going at a rate of $25 million for 4. Northrop Grumman recently received $20 million for its Global Hawk robot aircraft. While many businesses and working people are losing big time, Northrop is projected to earn $26 billion in revenues this year. I can mention all kinds of other companies, Lockheed Martin, Hughes, TRW, General Dynamics, making out like bandits while the rest of us are falling off the radar screen. The winners, by the way, include Halliburton, the construction company owned by Vice President Dick Cheney, which made $2.5 billion from the Department of Defense during the 1990s and is presently building bases in Afghanistan. This war is not only politically expedient, it's economically enriching for a handful of powerful corporations adequately represented in the White House and in Congress. Yet, as we all know, it's not their children that will fight, kill, and die in this war. It is ours. It's good that people are protesting. We need more protests. We need more people to take a stand. But see, we also need something else. Another level of participation that is not often given space, but that will ensure we go beyond reactive and defensive positions. What we need is what some of us are calling a poetics of peace, a poetics of healing, a poetics of caring. What we need is a language of compassion, bread, soul, need, heart, and the practical but reasonable demand for peace and justice in these violent and frightening times. What we need is art, creativity, song, story, organization, and compelling words to spark the fire of imagination and of meaningful and conscious struggle as seeds of an equitable and abundant world for all who carry blood in their veins and dreams in their heads. That's why I started with a poem this evening. A poem with a metaphor, an image, one of thousands that should now be evoked to help us maneuver through the swamp of narrow patriotism, warmongering, one or two syllable sentences and bush speeches, death and empire building that surrounds us at every turn. As Martin Luther King said about the Vietnam War more than 30 years ago, a time comes when silence is betrayal. We've come to that time again. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that calling to speak is often a vocation of agony, Martin also said. But we must speak. Yes, we must speak. We must find the connective words and images that bring together the broken pieces of community, of fractured class interests, of separate yet linked battles. We must act with poetry, not just protest, with a coherent vision, not just swirling rage, with science, spirituality, and the aspirations of millions on our sides, not just as helpless and confused victims of acts and policies beyond our grasp. William Stafford, a great poet, now dead, says, "There's a thread you follow." Yes, there's a thread running through all our lives, a golden thread that sometimes disappears, but is always there, even when we can't always see it. No matter what happens, as Stafford admonishes, never let go of that thread. I have a thread, the dream of a just and fair world, and the most powerful need to communicate this dream to that world. It's been with me all my life, through all my changes, through my adolescent rages and levels of maturity, through my failures, which are legion, and my accomplishments, few but golden in themselves. The forms change, the political organizational forms, the groups, the circles, the relationships, the periods of struggle, they all change, but that thread is still there. I learned when I was young, early on, that in our social system of things, something deep and important to each of us has to die. It's that part of you that wants to live the most, that must die so that you can take part and, quote, make it in this system. So you can be a component element of this intricate social machinery called capitalism, including the few and shallow excitements as part of a deep and abiding mundane existence. Like gamblers, we lose most of the time, but it's the few wins that keep us in the game. Quote, making it in this society doesn't require a Hollywood contract, a good paying job with benefits, being rich or powerful. Sometimes making it is barely able to pay your rent, get food on the table, barely able to make your card note. Sometimes you sacrifice that part of you that wants to really live just to make it. And then you don't even do that. Perhaps you've done everything right. You've gone to school, obtained decent grades, didn't rock any boats, clocked in on time at work and raised your families, and you're still not making it. You gave up that part of you that wants to be truly you, an authentic self that craved for a unique and fulfilling place in this world, and for what? Somehow, without any great awareness, I understood this at a young age. But it wasn't until I studied why this was so, until I learned what the root of the unfairness and oppression was about, until I studied why there were poor people and why there were rich, why we can be the most powerful and resource-laden country in the world, and there are still billions starving within our shores and beyond. I wasn't in tune, in line with the rest of humanity, until I learned why all the entertainment, shopping malls, video games, TV, and radio channels offering all kinds of distractions, that even in spite of that, we still feel empty, spiritually dead at times, and disconnected. I studied and became free. The thread became clear. I've gone through many changes in the 30 years since I first began to study these things. But I'm still here, still active, still hanging on to that thread while trying to live as full and complete a life as I can, as a revolutionary thinker, poet, and teacher. I've done this, like most of you, under the constraints of this limiting, pervasive, stupefying, and stagnant capitalist system that many of us have sacrificed our greatest dreams and ideals just to participate in. No more. The veil has been lifted. We know the powerful and rich don't have anything to give or provide the rest of us. except more neglect and indignities, more war and uncertainty. They have nothing for us. No trickle-down economics, no reforms, no safety nets, which were always used like a chain around our necks, so when the ruling classes wanted to yank us around, they did, until they eventually pulled the safety net from under our feet. The capitalists don't have any qualms about their self-centered and greedy objectives for profits, oil, world markets, and governments, including killing innocent children, women, and men to reach those objectives. This is written. It's in the books, within our memories. It's in the witness poems. Now the ruling class and its government wants to feed us again to their war monster, the Frankenstein they've created that they can no longer control. Our children will die along with the children of people and countries that don't have anywhere near the capacity to challenge our multi-billion dollar war machine. A war machine created for the capitalist class and their narrow interests, not for you and me, although many of us have become partners, mostly unwittingly, in these crimes. It's time to remove ourselves from this travesty, to stop having the illusion that this government, this class, these powerful and wealthy people can rebalance the exploitation and destruction of Earth and humankind that they themselves have partaken in for more than 500 years. I may not be all I can be, as the Marines say in their ads, but I still have that dream, that part of me that wants to live. I still have that thread. I've paid a big price for not giving in, for not dying inside, but I'm still here. We're all still here, still dreaming, still holding on. We're the ones who know that this is not the way things should be. I live my life in growing orbits, which move out over the things of the world. Perhaps I can never achieve the last, but that will be my attempt. I'm circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I've been circling for 1,000 years, and I still don't know if I'm a falcon or a storm or a great song. That's from Rainy O'Rourke, I Live My Life. So, how should things be? What can we imagine? Holding on to our threads, our truths, our stories about how things can be different. Let's share some of this. Again, it's not enough to protest what's wrong in this world. There's plenty of that to go around. It's not enough to just want something different. We have to know exactly what it is that will give us that life, that realization of our dreams, that innate need to be human, free, and creative. Let's share some of this. I have my ideas, but I'm no different than any of you. Let's share. Let's be clear. Let's know where we have to go so that the capitalists don't pull us back into their traps, their lures, their dreams for us of material things, status, and false power that ultimately will only keep us chained to their own madness. What will give us the knowledge, strength of consciousness, and resolve to not let the enormous power of the media keep us bound like handcuffs to our exploiters, destroyers, dream killers, and takers of that part of us that really wants to be. Not just living, breathing air, eating food, having kids, enjoying a good movie or a CD, but really to live. What can allow us not to lose track, get swayed, get lost, or get pulled back into the oblivions of our times? So let's share. Let's give. We're going into the future together. It's a shared tomorrow we're all facing. It can be one of war, hunger, spiritual vacuity, and sacrifice, or it can be one of cooperation, peace, and justice. Let's share. Let's choose. At least, let's say and describe exactly where we want to go, because we know we can. Instead of just expressing and dying with the doubts and uncertainties that the present state of affairs gives us only because we don't know it can be any other way. Tonight, we are going to reaffirm the power of sharing, of thinking, of studying, theorizing, planning, wishing, organizing, but also of doing. For there is no dream worth its salt that also does not also have a real and lasting impact on our lives and the lives of our children and for generations to come. I will leave you with the words by Subcomandante Marcos of the Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, the EZLN, of the Mayan lands in Chiapas. This is from a speech he gave in March of 1994. We must cultivate the powerful tree of a love that is a cleansing and healing wind. Not a small, egotistical love, but the grand one. The one that improves us and makes us grow. We must cultivate among us the tree of life and the tree of obligation. And we must water those trees with our whole lives, our bodies, our souls, our breath, and our hope. We must grow little by little, step by step. And we must not be afraid during the rise and fall of red stars, not be afraid of anything but surrender, of remaining in our seats and resting while others continue on, of taking a break while others struggle, sleeping while others are in march. And tonight, maybe for some of us, this is the first step of our march. For some of us, we've been marching all along. But we know that we have to bring more people along with us. Our children demand it. The future generation demands it. And these young people here demand it. We have to say, no more war. No more injustice. No more police beating on our kids. No more educational slashes. We deserve better than this. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're listening to Dreaming Revolution, a special presentation of People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. You can get more information about the League by calling 1-800-691-6888. 1-800-691-6888. Many people are questioning the necessity of a U.S.-led attack against Iraq, and many people are questioning the role and results of U.S. foreign policy around the world. But while billions of dollars are being spent on high-tech weaponry, the need for men and women to join the military, to fight, and perhaps to die remains. During the Vietnam War, it was America's poor and people of color who found themselves on the battle lines. 30 years later, it's still America's poor and people of color who find themselves the most heavily recruited. This topic was addressed at Dreaming Revolution 4 by two high school students, Christina and Jessica.
Christina came to me and started talking to me about the problems that were going on at her high school, Garfield High School. And I guess it really got to me because I don't go to a high school like Garfield High School. My high school is really hardly a high school. I go to an art high school. And it just struck me how different our schools are. And I don't know if it's because of the numbers of people that are in our schools. You know, what is it?
5,000.
5,000 to 500. I don't know if it's the number of minorities that are at her school that aren't really at mine. But things were really different, and we started realizing that as we talked and we exchanged ideas.
Statistics show that it's like 5 military recruiters to a college recruiter at our school.
At LOXA, there's no military recruiters. It was brought to my attention this week that we've seen one, and it was at a college fair, and nobody really noticed him or anything, and I don't think he really even talked to anybody. It's just a really, really huge contrast with Garfield.
How we said that the college recruiters, right? We have like one every few months, I would say, and if you want to go talk to them, you have to get a pass to get out. You have to go through all these steps. But if a military recruiter wants to come to your class, take over the whole class. So a question that we, you know, spoke about was, are our schools preparing us for our future or for battle?
At my school, I guess it's just assumed that everybody's going to college. It's an art school. You know that you're going to be a dancer. You know that you're going to be a visual artist, what have you. But you're going to college. We have a zero dropout rate. Garfield has a 50% dropout rate.
Something like that.
Garfield has a 50% dropout rate. With us, there's art colleges, conservatories coming to talk to us all the time. They don't leave us alone. With Christina, it's the military recruiters that are following them from class to class, waiting outside of their classrooms. Just really, really harsh, the way that they try and, you know, get these kids to enlist. False promises, putting them down, saying that that's the only thing that they're going to be able to do, that if they don't join the military, they're going to have to work at McDonald's. Which is, there's nothing wrong, you know, with not going to college. Working if you have to, but for them to tell Christina and other kids at Garfield that they're pretty much don't have a future if they don't join the military because they can't do anything else is really sad. And I don't think that they could ever get away with telling anybody at my school that. And I really don't think that that's right. One of the things that we've been bringing up a lot, and I think I just brought it up, was Why? Why Garfield? Garfield is in East LA. We're on the campus of Cal State LA. We're in City Terrace. Why is this happening at Garfield? Why isn't it happening at LOXA? Why aren't there military recruiters at LOXA? I really hate to turn to racism and say that it's racism, but I mean, you know, if it really fits the definition, and I think it really does, I think that's what it is. I mean, why aren't the kids at Garfield why don't they have such a promising future as the kids at LOXA? And it's not only the kids at LOXA and Garfield. It's something that's really sad, and it goes back to, I mean, what do people in higher places of authority, what do they tell us by their actions? Christina and I were talking in the car, and I mentioned to her that since 1948, $15 trillion have been spent on war efforts. That's more than all the schools, all the public buildings, all the roads, all the freeways in the U.S., all the human-made wealth in the U.S. put together, the U.S. has spent more on war efforts. And that's really just sending us a mixed message.
And instead of wasting that money on war, why don't they keep our clinics open for our people?
From San Francisco to Washington, D.C., from Paris to Tokyo, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators took to the world streets on Saturday, January 18th, to protest potential military action against Iraq by the Bush administration and its allies. In Washington, D.C., as many as 500,000 protesters rallied outside the Capitol, while in San Francisco, as many as 200,000 peace activists marched up Market Street from the Ferry Building to City Hall. With the Pentagon stepping up military preparations, including ordering more aircraft carriers to the Persian Gulf, thousands of demonstrators in cities from Moscow to London to Cairo called on the Bush administration to find a peaceful solution to the Iraq crisis. We bring you some of the sounds from the Peace March and Rally in San Francisco, California.
I want international answer and Free Palestine Alliance. And we are greatly honored to see people. As far as I see people who have driven in from San Diego, from Los Angeles, from Portland, Sacramento, from Davis, from Nevada City, California, from Nevada and Arizona, from all over the West Coast, to stand here all together with one single voice, to say one thing to the Bush administration and its fascists, that we don't want this bloody war. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We don't want your racist war.
5, 6, 7, 8.
No more killing, no more hate.
1, 2, 3, 4. We don't want your racist war. 5, 6, 7, 8.
No more killing, no more hate.
1, 2, 3, 4. We don't want your racist war.
California State Assemblyman Mark Leno.
It is very important that we all individually, collectively, let the administration in Washington know that this war is senseless. They have not made their case. A majority of Americans polled by the LA Times last week stated that the case has not been made for war, and the fallout from such senseless acts could be devastating to the entire global community.
Now, you've actually sponsored legislation that opposes this.
When I was on the County Board of Supervisors last year, I authored the resolution resolution which urged Congress to oppose Bush's war resolution. We passed it unanimously.
President pro tem of the California State Senate, John Burton.
Senator Burton, what role can California government have in trying to stop this war?
Well, unfortunately, the government can't do much. It's the people that are going to have to do it, and I think the people of California are going to do it.
What do you think people really need to do besides coming to this rally today?
Well, they have to let all of the politicians know that they are totally against this war. They have to keep organizing, writing letters, and doing the things necessary to keep public opinion going against the war. And so far, public opinion is you know, against the war. The president hasn't made his case, and we just have to keep the pressure up on the Congress and the politicians in Washington to let them know we're not going to tolerate them, you know, taking us into a war.
A number of cities are passing resolutions primarily against the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
Can any such legislation be introduced at the state?
Can be introduced. Whether or not we can pass it is another matter.
I'm here to take the responsibility that all of us have to take for what our government does in our name. And in a real sense, this is an eraser where we say you can't do this without our objection.
Bonnie Raitt.
I'm here because we're not going to be trading blood for oil. And this has got to stop, and there's a real mandate in this country to stop. There's a real mandate in this country. Most people, I think the latest poll is about 80% of the people don't feel there's enough reason to go to war. And we're celebrating today that there's a new way to look at energy and our dependence on oil and get the hell out of the Middle East and back onto wind and solar. So I'm here in support of the peace effort.
Taking back aluminum, getting paid by the pound, and I got so good at E-Trade that I could tell the sound of extra cycle going up and Bill Gates going down. Global warming turned out to be totally wrong. There were people wearing earmuffs all summer long. TV became illegal. Jesus was a stowaway with that one on the beagle. Winnie the Pooh turned out to be gay and got married to Jonathan Livingston Seymour. Whole animal kingdom went to the wedding. He
even though Pat Robertson would promise an Armageddon. I had a dream the world was redeemed for 10 cents. I had a dream that the world was redeemed for 10 cents. I had a dream that the world was redeemed for 10 cents. But all I had a nickel. Time Warner lost control of the mics they were controlling. George Bush got high, took the cabinet bowling. He declared martial law, made the stone stop rolling. They, of course, gathered moss in retaliation. Sold it to Egypt to help with their inflation. It was Northern Hemispheric economic salvation. Earth first put a dam on the Silicon River, turning Silicon Valley into Silicon Reservoir. But they called it a lake, but they called it a lake. They called it a lake, but they called it a lake. Didn't want the dot-commies to know it was fake. And the press bought it hook, line, and sinker. Dan Rather was admired for being an independent thinker. I had a dream the world was a dream for 10 cents. I had a dream that the world was a dream for 10 cents. I had a dream that the world was a dream for 10 cents. I had a dream that the world was a dream for 10 cents.
We're at the head of the march on Market Street, moving our way towards the Civic Center. Thousands upon thousands of people are in the streets in San Francisco.
I had a dream that the world was redeemed for 10 cents. McDonald's was under investigation by the DEA for selling incense to minors. Ken Starr got a raise from a secret admirer. Bill Shakespeare was working at the National Enquirer. Talking about Pamela's reduction in diameter. All the while scouting in Niagara compounder. Half the people in the world decided to leave after listening to this funny scouting and spouts about the trees being greener on the other side of the galaxy. Solving overpopulation in one fell swoop. Nostradamus got it going into therapy groups. Charlton Heston was banished to the planet of the apes after all his fans realized that raisins are just dried out grapes. I had a dream that the world was redeemed for 10 cents. I had a dream that the world was redeemed for 10 cents. If you didn't drive so much, if I didn't drive so much, we wouldn't have so much oil needing fighting for. That's why I say peace begins in the driveway. No oil, no oil war. 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 Ride your bicycle, please.
A small group of counter-protesters gathered across from the Civic Center in San Francisco. They were quickly confronted by a number of anti-war protesters.
Americans want that oil. You know it.
Why didn't we take it in 91?
And if you don't know that,
why didn't we take it in 91?
We are over here demanding the oil.
Why didn't we take it in 91?
Listen.
If we wanted the oil, why didn't we take it in 91?
That was the start of trying to get something we could not win.
Ma'am, that's not true.
That is true. That is true.
If we wanted the oil, we would have taken it in 91.
You need to look at history, past history. Look at past history and see which country we went after.
He's a little young, man.
I'm talking about Rumsfeld.
Well,
he was right. He said not a word.
I ain't Rumsfeld. I ain't saying
that. Isn't that a little fishy that he's running things now? You trust him going over there saying that there's some hidden weapons?
Yes, I do.
Finally, we talked with Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, who perhaps as much as any one single person helped bring the Vietnam War to an end. Ellsberg's release of the Pentagon Papers put him at the top of President Richard M. Nixon's enemies list. The Pentagon Papers proved that the U.S. government knew that the Vietnam War was destined to fail, but nevertheless continued to prosecute the war anyway. I asked Ellsberg to compare what was happening with today's anti-war movement with that of what took place during the Vietnam War.
This is far greater than the kinds of demonstrations they had at this stage of events in the Vietnam War or even somewhat later. This is probably the largest set of demonstrations against a war before it starts that we've ever seen. And that's very encouraging, although we have the experience of Vietnam to make people aware and to get it started. The fact is that when I was in the Pentagon, my first date with the woman who became my wife, we've been married for 32 years, was at the first march against the war. But then I was working in the Pentagon. I only came to it because she was there and that was the only way I could see her. But there were 20,000 people at that, which was much larger than they expected. The bombing had started after they scheduled it, and that brought out 20,000 people. But gee, 20,000, they'll have that many here when I get to speak an hour from now. Nearly everybody will have left by that time.
When we look at governmental policy, the policy the Bush administration is attempting to impose on the world, and we compare that with what was happening in the Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon administrations, your thoughts?
Well, we are being lied into this war as blatantly or egregiously as we were lied into the Vietnam War. In this case, we know a war is coming, which was not true in 64, 65, but the reasons for the war are being lied about and covered up as strongly as they could be. The notion that we're doing this as part of a war against terrorism is just backwards. We're jettisoning, in effect, a struggle against terrorism in favor of a war for oil, because this war is going to increase the danger of terrorism in this country for a whole number of reasons involved in the outrage it's going to cause among Muslim populations of the world and their unwillingness to see their governments cooperate with us against terrorists. It's going to enlarge the number of suicide recruits for terrorism by 100-fold probably. So we're endangering ourselves at home with this war. But the president, people still want to believe the president, and he's lying.
You put your freedom and perhaps your very life on the line by releasing the Pentagon Papers. What is it that motivates a person to do that? And where are the people who could and should be doing that today?
Well, the strong reason to do that is to save lives. And people in combat are used to risking their own lives for their buddies or for their team all the time. There are times when civilians should be considering doing the same, but we're not encouraged to do that because it means resisting our government on the whole when you do that. But the fact is that you can save lives by taking a risk of your own career and your own freedom, and of course, that's worthwhile.
From the San Francisco Peace March and Rally on January 18th, 2003, for KVMR FM Radio and People's Tribune Radio, I'm Mike Thornton.
The world was redeemed for 10 cents. McDonald's was under investigation by the DEA for selling incense to minors. Ken Starr got a raise on secret admirers.
For the vast majority of people from Dreaming Revolution, the issues of war and peace are not intellectual or philosophical topics. Whether as volunteers or part of a military draft, they'll be the ones who will be called upon to fight in this or other future wars. And even though young, history's lessons are not lost on them.
In the 60s, during the Vietnam War, they got rid of the baby boomers, so now they're trying to get rid of Generation X. So it's kind of like Vietnam. It's like we're fighting a war that we're not supposed to be fighting. We're just going in and getting ourselves killed.
You're listening to Dreaming Revolution, a special presentation of People's Tribune Radio. I'm Mike Thornton. Nelson Peary is the author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. Peary, himself a military veteran, discusses the role of warfare in the modern world.
When we ask about this question, or raise the question of modern war, people generally say, well, but there's always been wars. Yes, there's always been wars, there's always been work, but work is different today than it was 1,000 years ago, and wars today are different than they were 50, 60, 80 years ago, let alone 100 or 1,000 years ago. War in ancient times or in periods up until World War I, at least, wars primarily were to expand the national borders or to loot one country, you know, one country looting another country in order to take away its riches. But modern war is very tightly, very closely connected with the economy of the various countries. And so therefore, it's connected very tightly with the politics of these countries. The General Clausewitz talked about war being an extension of politics by other means, what he was really saying is that if you can't achieve your goal peacefully in the modern world, then you know, through the political developments, and you can't achieve your goal peacefully, then you take a violent means in order to achieve these goals. We have to look and ask ourselves, well, what are the goals in modern war? Or in politics today, in the political relations between countries, what are the goals that each country is looking at? Well, first of all, of course, we could always talk about their own national security and all that sort of a thing, but much more so from the side that we're talking about, how does one country control the resources of the earth in such a manner as to guarantee their own economic and political stability at the expense of the rest of the world? That's what World War I was fought about. That's what World War II was fought about, essentially. And that's what the Vietnamese War was fought about, the Korean War, the impending Iraqi War. All of them have this character of one nation attempting to use violent means in order to guarantee its own economic stability and its own slot, so to speak. It's a very complex thing, but I think that we ought to get at the root of it, and that root is economics. I think everybody senses that today. It's coming out very, very clear, for example, in the crisis between North Korea and the United States on one hand, and Iraq and the United States on the other hand. And everybody senses, everybody understands. Hey, we're taking a different approach to North Korea, not because they already have a nuclear weapon. In Iraq, they're talking about invasion. In North Korea, they're talking about diplomacy. Well, the obvious answer, of course, is that North Korea doesn't have any material resources that are absolutely necessary to the stability of the United States economy. And Iraq does. And no matter what the Iraqis do, that one way or another, the United States intends to control that oil, not necessarily to own it, but to control it, to control who it flows to, who gets it at what price, and so forth.
Peary discusses the new peace movement.
Well, I don't think you can really isolate the peace movement from everything else that is around it. If we were just to look at, zero in on the peace movement for the moment, I think we would have to say that the outstanding feature of the peace movement today is its grassroots character. The peace movement in World War I, in the Korean War, and in the Vietnam War and so forth was kind of transmitted into the people. There was a certain economic stability at that particular time of these wars. That is to say, that people had an economic stake, so to speak, in that war. They weren't suffering. The American people weren't suffering from the war. Matter of fact, they were, in a very big sense, gaining from the war, all those except who lost their children, of course, in the course of combat. So there was no foundation, there was nothing there for a peace sentiment or a peace movement to bubble up from the masses themselves. So therefore, it had to be put on a very moral basis, and by the left in the country, and the left then transplanted these ideas and ideals amongst the masses. And very, very slowly, the concept of peace, our anti-war concept, began to emerge. But it took quite some time. Here we see that this feature of the American people actually being against the war. There's a lot of reasons behind that. It's not simply the economy, and it's not simply, that I don't want my kid to get killed in that stupid war or anything like that. It's much more than that. It's a hangover from the Vietnamese War, where 3 million Vietnamese and something like 50,000 American soldiers died senselessly. That there was no reason for that war, and ever since Vietnam, of course, the people have gained more and more of a voice in the conduct of foreign affairs. Prior to World War II, and even prior to the Korean War, the American people had very little to say about how the American government conducted its foreign policy. But the Vietnam War, I think, changed all that. That the American people feel they have a right and they have an obligation to say something about the foreign policy of their government. And of course, this tremendous revulsion against not only killing of civilians, but of seeing their own children coming back in these body bags. Now, before, nobody questioned. They said, okay, we're going to war. Everybody beat the drums and waved the flag, and people went to war, and they assumed that the sacrifice of their children and their jobs and so forth and so on was a normal part of the process of national patriotism. But nobody's buying that today. That the memory of Vietnam is too deeply ingrained, and not only just Vietnam, but its consequences. You know, the whole situation around Nixon and so forth and so on. But the bottom part of it, the bottom line of it is that economically the American people are not well off. And we're seeing even before an invasion of Iraq, we're seeing a spiking of heating oil, of transportation costs that filter out through the entire economy, fueling a new inflation and lowering even more the standards of living of the American people. And along with this, we see the invasion by really fascist forces in the government of the United States to even further curtail the rights of the American people. Because, obviously, you know, these two things can't exist side by side. The rights of the people and the urge of the people to participate in foreign affairs on the one hand, and on the other hand, the desire of the government to do something that the people are actually opposed to. So we see that these various forces, some of them economic, some of them historically evolved political forces, are beginning to clash, and they're beginning to create a movement and a sentiment and a consciousness amongst the American people that's never, ever been there before. So what we're seeing, I think, is a very, very important thing, very important progression along the line of transition, along the line of revolutionary development within the United States as a whole.
You're listening to Dreaming Revolution. The following is an editorial written by correspondent Steve Miller in Oakland, California. It's becoming clear that Bush's war in Iraq is all about the control of oil. It's not really about SUVs. A country that controls the world's oil also controls the world's economy. The same forces that want war recognize the world's economy is globalizing at a rapid rate. They intend to exploit this historic development to further the corporate agenda for a new world order. Bush's economic policies at home are just as carefully planned to further this agenda. They will wreak havoc with our communities and threaten America with economic disaster and moral ruin. Bush's proposal for a $674 billion tax cut is unprecedented in U.S. history. It is the first time ever a president has proposed a tax break while starting a war. Bush's plan comes at a time when the federal government is operating at a deficit and the country is facing a recession. Every level of society is affected. The U.S. Conference of Governors has announced that the states are facing the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. At least 24 states are suddenly running deficits. As always, what's happening in California is a preview for what will happen to the rest of the country. Only 3 years ago, the state had a $10 billion surplus and was considering how to spend the money to improve the quality of life for its people. Suddenly, the electrical cartels began a carefully orchestrated series of blackouts to create the impression of a crisis. Now the state is facing a $30 billion deficit. So far, tens of billions of dollars of public wealth has been transferred to the private hands of the energy cartels. Now California is cutting back state and local services across the board. Governor Gray Davis's approach to the crisis is particularly telling. He's cutting the state's education budget by $5 billion, while increasing the prison budget by the same amount. At the federal level, President Bush isn't about to stop his program. By 2005, he plans to spend almost $500 billion a year on defense. This doesn't include either the war on Iraq, which is being carried off budget, or the future militarization of domestic life under the guise of homeland security. At first glance, these plans seem almost completely irrational. Where is all the money going to come from? The operating side of the government is already deeply in deficit. Just to pay for Bush's last tax cut of $1.75 trillion in 2001, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that Washington would have to divert $2 trillion from Social Security through the year 2012. The new tax cut, which will clearly benefit the rich, will be paid for by more withdrawals from Social Security, a program set up to benefit the poor. The master plan is to privatize and bankrupt Social Security, to loot state and local governments, and then the corporations will step in and privatize every service that government used to provide for free. Under the guise of cutting government red tape, the federal government has been shifting the burden for social programs onto the states, which has been rapidly shifting this burden onto the counties and to the cities. Suddenly, stories about cities going broke are becoming more common every day. The race to the bottom is alive and well. War on local governments is being planned, implemented, and organized at the highest levels. This system publicly declares to anyone who will listen that it will not fund what it can't exploit. Corporations are rapidly moving millions of jobs to countries where people do the same work for $5 a day and all the while throwing millions of other people out of work. These same corporations now tell us that there is no money to take care of the unemployed or alleviate poverty. Every generation of Americans has had to relearn the same brutal lesson. War abroad always means intensified war at home. If Bush can carry the war off budget at an estimated $20 billion a week, there's plenty of money to provide every person with decent food, shelter, education, and health care. A new world is coming into being. As long as Bush's tiny gang of exploiters controls this process, it'll lead to the dramatic ruin of the people of the world and the very planet itself. There's no way to prevent this by begging from within the system. The League of Revolutionaries for a New America advocates a revolutionary proposition that we can create a society based on the needs of the people. We can avoid the long, dark night that lies ahead by building a cooperative society where policies of war, bankruptcy, and ruin are replaced with plans to provide everyone with a decent and productive life. You've been listening to Dreaming Revolution, a special series of programs presented by People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with social and economic justice for all. If you'd like more information about the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print or audio publications, you can call us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888, or on the internet at www.lrna.org. Dreaming Revolution receives financial support from the Robeson Fund. Additional support for this program comes from KVMR FM Radio in Nevada City, California, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. My name's Mike Thornton, and this is Dreaming Revolution.